he was the person whose job it was to sit around the jail, so he would probably have to do it. Even worse, he would have to sit there for a month or two worrying about July's reaction when he finally got back. Or it could be 3 months or 6 months. July had been known to be slow. Roscoe knew he couldn't take 6 months of anxiety. Of course, it just proved that July had been foolish to marry, but it didn't make the situation any easier to live with. In less than an hour, it seemed that every single person in Fort Smith found out that July Johnson's wife had run off on a whiskey barge. It seemed the Johnson family provided almost all the excitement in town, the last excitement having been Benny's death. Such a stream of people came up to question Roscoe about the disappearance that he was forced to give up all thought of whittling, just at a time when having a stick to whittle on might have settled his nerves. People who had seldom laid eyes on Elmira suddenly showed up at the jail and began to question him about her habits, as if he was an authority on them, though all he had ever seen the woman do was cook a catfish or two. One of the worst was old Lady Harkness, who had once taught school somewhere or other in Mississippi and had treated grown-ups like schoolchildren ever since. She helped out a little in her son's general store, where evidently there wasn't work enough to keep her busy. She marched across the street as if she had been appointed by God to investigate the whole thing. Roscoe had already discussed it with the blacksmith and the postmaster and a couple of cotton farmers, and was hoping for a little time off in which to think it through. Old Lady Harkness didn't let that stop her. "Roscoe, if you was my deputy, I'd arrest you," she said. "What do you mean, letting somebody run off with July's wife?"
"Nobody run off with her," Roscoe said. "She just run off with herself, I guess."
"What do you know about it?" old Lady Harkness said. "I don't guess she'd just have got on a boat full of men if she wasn't partial to one of 'em. When are you going after her?"
"I ain't," Roscoe said, startled. It had never occurred to him to go after Elmira.
"Well, you will, unless you're good for nothing, I guess," the old lady said. "This ain't much of a town if things like that can happen, and the deputy just sit there."
"It never was much of a town," Roscoe reminded her, but the point, which was obvious, merely seemed to anger her.
"If you ain't up to getting that woman, then you better go get July," she said. "He might want his wife back before she gets up there somewhere and gets scalped."
Then she marched off, much to Roscoe's relief. He went in, took a drink or two from a bottle of whiskey he kept under his couch, and usually only used it as a remedy for toothache. He was careful not to drink too much, since the last thing he needed was for people in Fort Smith to get the notion he was a drunk. But then, the next thing he knew, despite his care, the whiskey bottle was empty, and he seemed to have drunk it, although it did not feel to him like he was drunk. In the still heat, he got drowsy and went to sleep on the couch, only to awake in a sweat to find Peach and Charlie Barnes staring down at him. It was very upsetting, for it seemed to him the day had started out with Peach and Charlie staring down at him. In his confusion, it occurred to him that he might have dreamed the whole business about Elmira running off. Only there were Peach and Charlie again. The dream might be starting over. He wanted to wake up before it got to the part about the whiskey barge, but it turned out he was awake, after all. "Is she still gone?" he asked, hoping by some miracle that Elmira had showed up while he was sleeping.
"Of course she's still gone," Peach said, "and you're drunk on the job. Get up from there and go get July."
"But July went to Texas," Roscoe said. "The only place I've ever been is Little Rock, and it's in the other direction."
"Roscoe, if you can't find Texas, you're a disgrace to your profession," Peach said. Peach had a habit of misunderstanding people, even when the point was most obvious.
"I can find Texas," he said. "The point is, can I find July?"
"He's riding with a boy, and he's going to San Antonio," Peach said. "I guess if you ask around, someone will have seen them."
"Yeah, but what if I miss him?" Roscoe asked.
"Then I guess you'll end up in California," she said. Roscoe found that he had a headache, and listening to Peach made it worse.
"His wife's gone," Charlie Barnes said.
"Darn it, Charlie, shut up," Peach said. "He knows that.
I don't think he's forgot that.
Roscoe had not forgotten it. Overnight, it had become the dominant fact of his life. Elmira was gone, and he was expected to do something about it. Moreover, his choices were limited. Either he went upriver and tried to find Elmira, or he had to go to Texas and look for July. He himself was far from sure that either action was wise. Trying to recover his wits with a headache and Peach and Charlie Barnes staring at him for the second time that day was not easy. Mainly, Roscoe felt aggrieved that July had put him in such a position. July had been doing well enough without a wife, it seemed to Roscoe. But if he had to marry, he could have been a little more careful and at least married someone who would have the courtesy to stay around Fort Smith, about the least that one ought to be able to ask of a wife. Instead, he had made the worst possible choice and left Roscoe to suffer the consequences.
"I ain't much of a traveler," Roscoe said, for actually his one trip to Little Rock had been one of the nightmares of his life, since he had ridden the whole way in the cold rain and had run a fever for a month as a result. Nonetheless, the next morning he found himself saddling up a big white gelding he had ridden for the last 10 years, a horse named Memphis, the town of his origin. Several of the townspeople were there at the jail, watching him pack his bedroll and tie on his rifle scabbard, and none of them seemed worried that he was about to ride off and leave them unprotected. Although Roscoe said little, he felt very pettish towards the citizens of Fort Smith, and toward Peach Johnson and Charlie Barnes in particular. If Peach had just minded her own business, nobody would even have discovered that Elmira was missing until July returned, and then July would have been able to take care of the problem, which was rightly his problem anyway.
"Well, I hope nobody don't rob the bank while I'm gone," he said to the little crowd watching him. He wanted to suggest worse possibilities, such as Indian raids, but in fact the Indians had not molested Fort Smith in years, though the main reason he rode white horses was that he had heard somewhere that Indians were afraid of them. The remark about the bank being robbed was aimed at Charlie Barnes, who blinked a couple of times in response. It had never been robbed, but if it had been, Charlie might have died on the spot, not out of fright, but because he hated to lose a nickel. The little jail, which had been more or less Roscoe's home for the last few years, had never seemed more appealing to him. Indeed, he felt like crying every time he looked at it, but of course it would not do to cry in front of half the town. It was another beautiful morning with the hint of summer. Roscoe had always loved the summer and hated the cold, and he wondered if he would get back in time to enjoy the sultry days of July and August, when it was so hot even the river hardly seemed to move. He was much given to premonitions, had had them all his life, and he had a premonition now. It seemed to him that he wouldn't get back. It seemed to him he might be looking his last on Fort Smith, but the townspeople gave him no chance to linger or be sorry.
"Elmira'll be to Canada before you get started," Peach pointed out.
Reluctantly, Roscoe climbed up on Memphis, a horse so tall it was only necessary to be on him to have a view.
"Well, I hate to go off and leave you without no deputy," he said. "I doubt if July will like it. He put me in charge of this place."
Nobody said a word to that.
"If July gets back and I ain't with him, you tell him I went looking," Roscoe said. "We may just circle around for a while, me and July. First I'll look for him, and then he can look for me. And if the town goes to hell in the meantime, don't blame it on Roscoe Brown."
"Roscoe, we got the fort over there half a mile away," Pete said. "I guess the soldiers can look after us as good as you can." That was true, of course. There wouldn't even be a Fort Smith if there hadn't been a fort first. Still, the soldiers didn't concern themselves much with the town.
"What if Elmira comes back?" Roscoe asked.
No one had raised that possibility.
"Then I'd be gone and won't know it."
"Why would she come back?" Peach asked. "She just left." Roscoe found it hard even to remember Elmira, though he had done practically nothing but think about her for the last 24 hours. All he really knew was that he hated to ride out of the one town he felt at home in. That everyone was eager for him to go made him feel distinctly bitter.
"Well, a soldier's ain't going to help you if old man Darton goes on a tear," he said. "July told me to be sure and watch him."
But the little group of citizens seemed not to be worried by the thought of what old man Darton might do. They watched him silently, unable to think of any other warnings or any reason for his staying that might convince anyone. Roscoe gave Memphis a good kick. He was a steady horse once he hit his stride, but he did start slow, and the big-footed gelding kicked a little dust on Charlie Barnes' shiny shoes getting underway. Roscoe took one last look at the river and headed for Texas.
Chapter 30
The first good wash Lorena got was in the Nueces River. They had had a bad day trying to fight their way through the mesquite thickets, and when they came to the river, she just decided to stop, particularly since she found a shady spot where there wasn't any mesquite or prickly pear. Jake had had no part in the decision because Jake was drunk. He had been steadily drinking whiskey all day as they rode. He was so unsteady in his seat that Lorena wasn't even sure that they were still going in the right direction, but they were ahead of the cattle. From every clearing, she could look back and see the dust the herd raised. It was a fair way back, but directly behind them, which made her feel reassured. It would not be pleasant to be lost with Jake so drunk. Of course, he only drank because his hand was paining him. Probably he hadn't gotten all the thorn out. His thumb had turned from white to purple. She was hoping they would strike a town that had a doctor, but there seemed to be nothing in that part of the country but prickly pear and mesquite. It was bad luck, Jake having an accident so soon after they started, but it was just a thorn. Lorena supposed the worst it could do was fester. But when he got off his horse, his legs were so unsteady he could barely wobble over to the shade. She was left to tie the horses and make the camp, while Jake lay propped up against a tree and continued to pull on his bottle. "Darn, it's hot," he said, when she stopped for a minute to look at his hand. "I wonder where the boys are camped tonight. We might go over and get up a game of cards." "You'd lose," she said. "You're too drunk to shuffle." There was a flash of anger in Jake's eyes. He didn't like being criticized, but he made no retort. "I'm going to have a wash," Lorena said. "Don't drown," he said. "Be a pity if you was to drown on your way to San Francisco." It was clear he was angry. He hated to be denied, or to see her take the lead over him in anything. Lorena met his anger with silence. She knew he couldn't stay mad very long. The river was green and the water cold underneath the surface. She waded in and stood chest deep, letting the water wash away the layers of dust and sweat. As she was wading out, feeling clean and light, she got a scare. A big snapping turtle sat on the bank right where she had entered the river. It was as big as a tub and so ugly Lorena didn't want to get near it. She waded upstream, and just as she got out, heard a shot. Jake was shooting his pistol at the turtle. He walked down to the water, probably just because he liked to see her naked. "You are a sight," he said, grinning. Then he shot at the turtle again and missed. He shot four times, all the bullets plopping into the mud. The turtle, unharmed, slid off into the water. "I was never no shot with my left hand," Jake said. Lorena sat down on a grassy place in the sun and let the water drip off her legs. And as soon as she sat down, Jake came over and began to rub her back. He had a feverish look in his eye. "I don't know where I got such a fancy for you," he said. "You are a sight to see." He stretched out beside her and pulled her back. It was odd to look up beyond his head and see the white sky above them instead of the cracked boards in the ceiling above her head and the dry bean. More than usual, it made her feel not there, far from Jake and what he was doing. Crowded up in a room, it was difficult for her to keep herself. On the grass, with the sky far above, it was easy. But it was not easy for Jake to finish. He was sicker than she had suspected. His legs were trembling and his body strained at hers. She looked in his face and saw he was frightened. He groaned, trying to grip her shoulder with a sore hand. Then, despite himself, he slipped from her. He tried to push back in, but he kept slipping away. Finally, he gave up and collapsed on her, so tired that he seemed to pass out. When he sat up, she eased out from under him. He looked around with no recognition. She dressed, helped him dress, and got him propped up against a big shade tree. She made a little fire, thinking some coffee might help him. While she was getting the pot out of the pack, she heard a splashing and looked up to see a black man ride his horse into the river from the other side. Soon the horse was swimming, but the black man didn't seem frightened. The horse waded out, dripping, and the black man dismounted and let it shake itself. "How do, miss?" the black man said. Jake had fallen into a drowse and didn't even know the man was there. "Mr. Jake taking a nap?" he asked. "He's sick," Lorena said. The man walked over and squatted by Jake a moment, then gently lifted his hand. Jake woke up. "Why, it's old Dietz," he said. "We're all right now, Lori. Dietz'll see us through." "I've been looking for a good place to cross the herd," Dietz said. "Captain made me scout." "Well, he's right," Jake said. "We'd all have been lost 20 years ago if it hadn't been for you." "You full of fever," Dietz said. "Let me get that sticker out of your hand." "I thought I got it all the other day," Jake said. "I'd as soon have you cut my hand off as dig around in there." "Oh, no," Dietz said. "You got to keep that hand. Might need you to shoot a bandit if one gets after me." He went back and rummaged in the saddlebag, bringing out a large needle. "I got to keep a needle," he said to Lorena. "Got to sew my pants from time to time." Then, after heating the needle and letting it cool, he carefully probed the swelling at the base of Jake's thumb. Jake yelped when he began, then yelped again a little later, but he didn't resist. "God damn them darn thorns," he said weakly. Then, with a wide grin, Dietz held up the needle. The tiny yellow tip of the thorn was on it. "Now you be cutting the cards again," he said. Jake looked relieved, though still flushed with fever. "I'll play right now, Dietz," he said. "You're the only one in the whole darn outfit with any money." The black man just grinned and returned the needle to the little packet in the saddlebag. Then he accepted the cup of coffee which Lori offered. "Miss, you ought to get him across the river," he said when he handed back the coffee cup. "Why?" Lorena asked. "We done made camp. He'll want to rest." "Rest on the other side," Dietz said. "Gonna come a storm tonight. River'll be up tomorrow." It seemed hard to believe. There was not a cloud in the sky, but the man had spoken in a tone that indicated he knew what he was talking about. The girl looked sad, Dietz thought. He glanced at the sun, which was dropping. "I can help," he said. "I'll get you settled." The black man had them packed in no time, tying their bedrolls high so as to keep them out of the river. "Dern, we didn't use this camp much," Jake said when he realized they were moving. But when Dietz mentioned the storm, he simply mounted and rode into the river. He was soon across. It was a good thing Dietz had offered to help. Lorena's mare balked and wouldn't take the water. She would go in chest deep and then whirl and climb back up the bank, showing the whites of her eyes and trying to run. Despite herself, Lorena felt her fear rising. Once already, the mare had nearly fallen. She might really fall, trapping Lorena beneath the green water. She tried to control her fear. She would have to get across many rivers if she was to get to San Francisco. But the mare kept flouncing and trying to turn, and Lorena couldn't help being afraid. She could see Jake on the other bank. He didn't look very concerned. The third time the mare turned, the black man was suddenly beside her. "Let me have her," he said. When he took the reins, Lorena felt a deeper fright than she had ever known. She gripped the horse's mane so tightly horsehairs cut into her hands. Then she shut her eyes. She couldn't bear to see the water coming over her. The mare took a leap, There was a different feeling. They were swimming. She heard the black man's voice talking soothingly to the mare. The water lapped at her waist, but it came no higher. After a moment, she opened her eyes. They were nearly across the river. The black man was looking back watchfully, lifting her reins a bit so as to keep the horse's head out of the water. Then there was a suck of water against her legs as they started to climb out of the river. With a smile, the black man handed her back her wet reins. She was gripping the mane so tightly it took an act of will to turn her hands loose.
"Why, she's a fine swimmer," Dietz said. "You'll be fine on this horse, miss."
Lorena had clenched her teeth so tightly she couldn't even speak to thank the man, though she felt a flush of gratitude. Had it not been for him, she felt sure that she would have drowned. Jake, by this time, had untied his bedroll and thrown it down under a big mesquite. It had been nothing to him, her having to cross the river. Though the fright had begun to relax its grip, Lorena still didn't feel that she had control of her limbs so that she could simply step off the horse and walk as she had always walked. She felt angry at Jake for taking it all so lightly. Neat smiled at Lorena tolerantly and turned his own horse back toward the river.
"Make your fire and do your cooking now," he said. "Then blow out the fire. It's going to come a bad wind. If the fire gets loose, you might have trouble."
He glanced south at the sky.
"The wind's going to come about sundown," he said. "First it will be sand, and then lightning. Don't tie the horses to no big trees."
Despite herself, Lorena felt her spirits sinking. She had always feared lightning above all things, and here she was, without even a house to hide in. She saw it was going to be harder than she had imagined. Here it was only the second day, and she had already had a fright like death. Now lightning was coming. For a moment it all felt hopeless. Better she had just sat in the dry bean for life. It was all foolish, her dream of San Francisco. She looked again at the black man, meaning to try and thank him for helping her across the river, but he was looking at her kindly, and she didn't say anything.
"I got to go lead the captain to the crossing," he said.
Lorena nodded. "Tell Gus hello," she said.
"I'll tell him," Dietz said, and rode into the Nueces for the third time.
Chapter 31.
"Well, here's where we all find out if we was meant to be cowboys," Augustus said.
For he had no doubt that Dietz would soon be proved right about the coming storm.
"Too bad it couldn't wait a day or two until some of you boys had some more practice," he added. "I expect half of you will get trampled before the night is over, leaving me no way to collect my just debts."
"We have to expect it," Carl said. "It's the stormy time of the year." Still, a sandstorm at night, with a herd that wasn't trail-broken, and a green crew of men, was not going to be anything to look forward to.
"You reckon we could make it across the river before it hits?" he asked.
But Dietz shook his head. They were several miles from the Nueces, and the sun was low.
"It's a steep crossing," Dietz said. "You don't want to hit it in the dark."
Newt had just come off the drags for a drink of water, and the first thing he heard was talk of sandstorm. It didn't seem to him that it would make much difference. His world was mostly sand anyway. He had to rinse his mouth 5 or 6 times before he could even eat a plate of beans without swallowing grit with them. Carl felt uncertain. He had never had to plan for a storm in brushy country with a fresh herd of cattle. There were so many factors to consider that he felt passive for a moment, an old feeling he knew well from his years of rangering. Often in a tight situation, his mind would seem to grow tired from so much hard thinking. He would sink for a time into a blankness, only to come out of it in the midst of an action he had not planned. He was never conscious of the trigger that set him back in motion, but something always pulled it, and he would find himself moving before he was conscious that it was time to move. Already he could feel a change in the wind. The day had been still, but there was a hot breath against his cheek coming from the south. He had waited out many such winds in Lonesome Dove, with the sand swirling up from Mexico so fast it felt like birdshot when it hit the skin. The hellbitch looked around restlessly, well aware of what was coming.
"It's going to be a muddy sundown, boys," Augustus said. In fact, the sun was barely visible, only its edges showing yellow and the disk itself dark, as if in an eclipse. To the west and south, the sand was rising in the clear sky like a brown curtain, though far above it the evening star was still bright. Bolivar stopped the wagon and went back to dig around in the piles of bedrolls, looking for his serape. "Go tell Dish and Soupy to hold up the cattle," Carl said to Newt. The boy felt proud to have been given a commission and loped around the herd until he came to the point. The cattle were behaving quietly, just walking along, grazing, when there was anything to graze on. Dish was slouched at ease in the saddle. "I guess this means you've been promoted," he said when Newt rode up. "Or else I've been demoted." "We're getting a storm," Newt said. "Captain says to hold 'em up." Dish looked at the sky and loosened his bandana. "I wish the darn storms learned to get here in the daytime," he said with a grin. "I don't know why, but they generally strike just when I'm ready to catch a nap." His attitude toward the storm was contemptuous, as befitted a top hand. Newt tried to imitate his manner, but couldn't bring it off. He had never been out in a sandstorm at night, with thousands of cattle to control, and was not looking forward to the experience, which began almost immediately. Before he could get around the herd to Soupy, the sand was blowing. The sun disappeared as if someone had popped a lid over it, and a heavy half-light filled the plains for a few minutes. "By God, it looks like a good one coming," Soupy said, adjusting his bandana over his nose and pulling his hat down tight on his head. The loss of hats due to sudden gusts of wind had become a larger problem than Newt would have thought it could be. They were always blowing off, spooking horses or cattle or both. He was grateful to Dietz for having fixed the little rawhide string onto his so that he had been spared the embarrassment of losing it at crucial times. Newt had meant to go back to the wagon, but the storm gave him no time. While Soupy was fixing his bandana, they looked around and saw streams of sand like small, low clouds blowing in the dim light through the mesquite just to the south. The little clouds of sand seemed like live things, slipping around the mesquite and by the chaparral as a running wolf might, sliding under the bellies of the cattle and then rising a little to blow over their backs. But behind the little sand streams came a river, composed not of water but of sand. Newt only glanced once to get his directions. Then the sand filled his eyes so that he was immediately blind. It was in his first moment of blindness that the cattle began to run, as if pushed into motion by the river of sand. Newt heard Soupy's horse break into a run, and Mouse instantly was running, too. But running where? Newt had no idea. He dug a finger into his eyes, hoping to get the sand out, but it was like grinding them with sandpaper. Tears flowed, but the sand turned them to mud on his lashes. Now and then he would get a blurred glimpse out of one eye, and at the first glimpse was horrified to discover that he was in among the cattle. A horn nudged his leg, but Mouse swerved and nothing more happened. Newt stopped worrying about seeing and concentrated on keeping his seat. He knew Mouse could leap any bush not higher than his head. He felt a horrible sense of failure, for surely he had not done his job. The captain had not meant for him to stay near the head of the herd. He was there because he had not moved quick enough. And it was his fault if he was doomed, as he assumed he was. Once he thought he heard a whoop, and was encouraged, but the sound was instantly sucked away by the wind. The wind keened like a cry, its tone rising over the lower tone of the pounding hooves. When Newt began to be able to see again, it did him little good, for it was then almost pitch dark. Over the roar of the wind and the running herd, he suddenly heard the popping of tree limbs. A second later, a mesquite limb hit him in the face, and the brush tore at him from all sides. He knew they had hit a thicket, and assumed it was his end. Mouse faltered and almost went to his knees, but managed to right himself. All Newt could do was duck as low over the horn as possible and hold his arms in front of his face. To his great relief, the running cattle soon slowed. The brush was so thick it checked them as a herd, though the same thicket soon divided them into several groups. The bunch Newt was with slowed to a trot and then a walk. Mouse's sides were slick with sweat. Newt felt it was a miracle that he was still alive. Then he heard pistol shots ahead to his right.
A string of cracks, the sound instantly taken by the wind. The wind seemed to be increasing. When he tried to straighten up in the saddle, it was like pushing his back against a heavy door. He tried to turn Mouse because he still hoped to get back to the rear where he belonged, but Mouse wouldn't turn. It angered Newt. He was supposed to be making the decisions, not Mouse. The horse would circle, but he wouldn't go into the wind, and Newt finally gave up, aware that he probably couldn't find the wagon or the main herd anyway. In the short lulls in the wind, he could hear the clicking of longhorns as the cattle bumped into one another in the darkness. They were walking slowly, and Newt let Mouse walk along beside them. He had worried as much as he could, and he simply rode, his mind blank. It seemed like he had been riding long enough for the night to be over, but it wasn't, and the sand still stung his skin. He was surprised suddenly by a flicker of light to the west, so quick and so soon lost that he didn't at first recognize it as lightning. But it flickered again and soon was almost constant, though still far away. At first, Newt welcomed it. It enabled him to see that he was still with the several hundred cattle and also helped him avoid thickets. But as the lightning came closer, thunder came with it. The sound seemed to roll over them like giant boulders. Mouse flinched, and Newt began to flinch, too. Then, instead of running across the horizon like snakes' tongues, the lightning began to drive into the earth with streaks thick as poles and with terrible cracks. In one of the flashes, Newt saw Dish Boget not 30 yards away, and Dish saw him, too, and came toward him. In the next flash, Newt saw Dish pulling on a yellow slicker. "Where's Soupy?" Dish asked. Newt had no idea. "He must have got turned wrong," Dish said. "We got most of the cattle. You should have brought a slicker. We're going to get some rain." As the flashes continued, Newt strained his eyes to keep Dish in sight, but soon lost him. To his amazement, he saw that the cattle seemed to have caught the lightning. Little blue balls of it rolled along their horns. While he was watching the strange sight, a horse bumped his. It was Dietz. "Ride off the cattle," he said. "Don't get close to them when they got the lightning on their horns. Get away from them." Newt needed no urging, for the sight was scary, and he remembered Dish describing how lightning had hit a cowboy he knew and turned him black. He wanted to ask Dietz some questions, but between one flash and another, Dietz vanished. The wind had become fitful, gusting and then dying, and instead of beating steadily at his back, the sand was fitful too, swirling around him one moment and gone the next. In the flashes of lightning, he could see that the sky was clearing high to the east, but a wall of clouds loomed to the west, the lightning darting underneath them. Almost before the last of the sand had stung his eyes, it seemed, the rain began, pelting down in big scattered drops that felt good after all the grit. But the drops got thicker and less scattered, and soon the rain fell in sheets, blown this way and that at first by the fitful wind. Then the world simply turned to water. In a bright flash of lightning, Newt saw a wet, frightened coyote run across a few feet in front of Mouse. After that, he saw nothing. The water beat down more heavily than even the wind and the sand. It pounded him and ran in streams off his hat brim. Once again, he gave up and simply sat and let Mouse do what he wanted. As far as he knew, he was completely lost, for he had moved away from the herd in order to escape the lightning and had no sense that he was anywhere near the herd. The rain was so heavy that at moments he felt it might drown him right on his horse. It blew in his face and poured into his lip from his hat brim. He had always heard that cowboying involved considerable weather, but had never expected so many different kinds to happen in one night. An hour before, he had been so hot he thought he could never be cool again, but the drenching water had already made him cold. Mouse was just as dejected and confused as he was. The ground was covered with water. There was nothing to do but splash along. To make matters worse, they hit another thicket and had to back out, for the wet mesquite had become quite impenetrable. When they finally got around it, the rain had increased in force. Mouse stopped, and Newt led him. There was no use proceeding when they didn't know where they needed to proceed. The water pouring off his hat brim was an awkward thing. One stream in front, one stream behind. A stream of water poured right in front of his nose while another sluiced down his back. Then Mouse began to move again, and Newt heard the splashing of a horse ahead. He didn't know if it carried a friendly rider, but Mouse seemed to think so, for he was trotting through the hawk-high water, trying to locate the other horse. In one of the weakening flashes of lightning, Newt saw cattle trotting along 50 yards to his right. Suddenly, with no warning, Mouse began to slide. His back feet almost went out from under him. They had struck a gully, and Newt felt water rising up his legs. Fortunately, it wasn't a deep gully. Mouse regained his balance and struggled through it, as scared as Newt. There was nothing to do but plod on. Newt remembered how happy he had been when dawn finally came the night they had gone to Mexico. If he could just see such a dawn again, he would know how to appreciate it. He was so wet it didn't seem as if he could ever be dry, or that he could do such a simple thing as sit in the bright sun again, feeling hot, or stretch out on the grass and sleep. As it was, he couldn't even yawn without water blowing in his mouth. Soon he got too tired to think, could only hope that it would finally be morning. But the night went on and on. The lightning died, and the hard rain stopped. But a drizzle continued. They hit intermittent patches of thick brush and had to back and turn and go on as best they could. When he had crossed the gully, one boot had filled with water. Newt wanted to stop and empty it, but what if he dropped it and couldn't find it in the dark, or got off and couldn't get back on? A fine sight he would make if he ever saw camp again, riding in with one boot in his hand. Thinking about the ridicule that would involve, he decided just to let the boot squish. All the same, he felt proud of Mouse, for many horses would have fallen, sliding into the gully. "Good horse," he said. "If we just keep going, maybe it'll get light." Mouse swung his head to get his wet forelock out of his eyes and kept on plodding through the mud.
Chapter 32.
Jake had forgotten to hobble the horses. He remembered it when the first lightning struck and Lorena's young mare suddenly snapped the rein and ran off. It was dark and the sand was still blowing. He managed to get the hobbles on his own horse and the pack mule, but had to let the mare go. "She won't go far," he said when he got back to Lori. She was huddled under a blanket, her back against a big mesquite tree and her legs half buried in the sand. "No better than she likes to swim. I expect we'll find her on this side of the river," Jake said. Lorena didn't answer. The lightning filled her with such tension that she didn't think she could endure it. If it went on much longer, she felt it would twist her like a wire. She held the blanket around her as tightly as she could, and her teeth were clenched as they had been when she crossed the river. She kept trying to think about something besides the lightning, but she couldn't. She kept thinking of how it would feel if it hit her. It was said to be like a burn, but how could a burn travel through your body in an instant? Then the lightning began to strike in the trees nearby, with a crack so loud that it made her head ring. She didn't mind the wet. Jake tried to rig a tarp, but it wasn't big enough. A bolt hit just behind them, with a sound so loud that it took her breath. "I want to go back," she thought. When she got her breath back, she was crying, the tears mingling with the rain on her face. "We got to get out from under this darn tree," Jake yelled. Lorena didn't move. He was crazy. The tree was all that was keeping them from death. Out in the open, the lightning would immediately strike them. But Jake began to pull at her. "Come on," he said. "We'll get under the bank. It might strike the tree." The lightning had become constant. She could see every whisker on Jake's face in the glare. He looked old, but he wouldn't leave her under the tree. In the flashes, she could see the river. The river had almost got her, and now he wanted her to go back to it. When he pulled, she fought. The tree was the only protection she had, and she didn't want to leave it. "Darn it, come on," Jake said. "This ain't no place to sit out a lightning storm." Every time he pulled, the tightness inside her broke out a little, and she struck at him. The first blow hit him in the eye, and he slipped and sat down in the mud. Then it was dark. When the lightning flashed again, she saw Jake trying to get up, a look of surprise on his face, but he grabbed her in the darkness and began to drag her away from the tree. She kicked at him, and they both went down, but a bolt struck so loud and so near that she forgot to fight. She let him pull her toward the river, dragging the tarp. Another bolt hit so near it shook the ground, almost causing Jake to fall in the water. There was not much overhang to the bank, and the tarp was so muddy he could barely drag it, but he pulled it over them and sat close to her, shivering. In the flashes, the light was so bright that she could see every wavelet on the river. She wondered where the turtle was, but before she could look, it was pitch dark again. In the next flash, she saw the horses jumping and trying to shake off their hobbles. She shut her eyes, but when the bolts hit, she felt the light on her eyelids. There was nothing to do but wait to die. Jake was shivering against her. She felt her muscles coiling up, getting tighter and tighter. "Well, I wish we'd brought our feather bed," Jake said, trying to make light of it. She opened her eyes to blackness, and a second later saw the lightning come to earth just across the river, cracking into the tree where they had made their first camp. The tree split at the top, then darkness fell, and when the next flash came, the split part had fallen to the ground. "We got old Dietz to thank that we're still alive," Jake said. "That one would have got us if we'd stayed put." "You didn't thank him," Lorena thought. She put her head against her knees and waited.
Chapter 33.
By dawn, the rain had stopped completely and the sky was cloudless. The first sunlight sparkled on the wet thickets and hundreds of puddles scattered among them, on the wet hides of the cattle and the dripping horses. At the head of the main bunch of cattle, Call surveyed the situation without too much apprehension. Unless there was a lightning victim somewhere, they had come through the storm well. The cattle had walked themselves out and were docile for the time being. Dietz had been to look, and Soupy, Jasper, and Needle had the rest of the herd a mile or two east. The wagon was stuck in a gully, but when the hands gathered, they soon had enough ropes on it to pull it out. Bull refused to budge from the wagon seat while a pull-out took place. Lippy had got out to help push, and consequently was covered with mud practically up to his lip. Newt had been extremely surprised when dawn came, to discover that he was in his natural position in relation to the herd, behind it. He was too tired even to feel very relieved. All he wanted to do was stretch out and sleep. Several times he dozed off, sitting straight up in the saddle. Mouse was just as tired and kept to a slow walk. Dietz reported that all the hands were well and accounted for, with the exception of Mr. Gus. He had been with the main herd for a while, but now he was nowhere to be seen. "He probably rode off to the cafe to get his breakfast," Dish Boget said, "or else went into San Antone to get himself a shave." "He might have went to see Mr. Jake," Dietz said. "Want me to go look?" "Yes, have a look," Call said. "I want to cross the river as soon as possible, and it would be convenient to have Gus along." "It ain't much of a river," Dish said. "I could near jump across it if I had a long-legged horse." When asked how many cattle he thought might be lost, Dish estimated no more than 25 head, if that many. "Well, you nearly lost me," Jasper Fant said, when they were all standing around the wagon. Bowell had some dry wood that he kept under a tarp, but the preparation of victuals was going too slowly to suit most of the hands. "I'm so tired I won't be worth nothing for a week," Jasper added. "When was you ever worth anything?" Dish inquired. He himself was in rather good fettle. It always improved his mood to have his skill recognized, as it clearly was by all the hands. He had managed to turn the main part of the herd out of the worst of the brush and keep it together. Even Captain Call had seemed impressed. The only cowboy who had not performed up to caliber in the emergency was Sean O'Brien, who had been walking out to catch his night horse when the storm hit. He was such a poor roper that Newt usually roped his horses for him, if he happened to be around. This time, of course, he hadn't been. The Speddles, responsible for the remuda, were afraid Sean's awkward roping would cause the whole herd to bolt. Bill Speddle had roped a horse for him, but it wasn't one he could ride. Sean had promptly been bucked off, and when the remuda did bolt, Sean's horse ran with it. Sean had been forced to ride in the wagon all night, more worried for his life than his reputation. Bolivar had made it clear that he didn't like passengers. While breakfast was cooking, most of the cowboys pulled off their shirts and spread them out on bushes to dry. A few took off their pants, too, but only the few who possessed long underwear. Dish Boget was one of the few who had carefully wrapped his extra clothes in an oilcloth, so he soon had on dry pants and a shirt, which somewhat increased his sense of superiority to the rest of the crew. "You boys look like a darn bunch of wet chickens," he said. It was true that the crew presented an odd appearance, though Newt wouldn't have compared them to chickens. Most of them were burned a deep brown on the face, neck, and hands, but the rest of their bodies, which the sun never touched, were stark white. Bert Borum was the funniest looking without a shirt, for he had a round, fat belly with curly black on it that ran right down into his pants. P.I. walked around in a pair of all-enveloping long johns, which he had worn continuously for the last several years. He had his knife and gun belt on over his underwear in case of sudden attack. "There ain't no point in getting too dry," he pointed out. "We got to cross the river after a while." "I'd just soon go around it," Needle said. "I've crossed it many times, but I've been lucky." "I'll be glad to cross it. Maybe I'll get a wash," Lippy said. "I can't do much under all this mud." "Why, that ain't a river. It's just a creek," Dish said. "The last time I crossed it, I didn't even notice it." "I guess you'll notice it if 5 or 6 of them heifers get on top of you," Jasper said. "It's just the first of many," Bert said. "How many rivers is it between here and the Yellowstone?" The question set everyone to counting and arguing, for as soon as they decided they had an accurate count, someone would think of another stream, and there would be a discussion as to whether it should count as a river. The Rainey boys were sleeping under the wagon. Both had dropped like rocks once they dismounted, oblivious to wet clothes and too tired to be interested in food. The Raineys liked their sleep, whereas the Speddles could do without it. They seemed unaffected by the strenuous night. They sat apart, as silent as always.
"I wish they'd talk, so we'd know what they were thinking," Sean said. The silent Speddles made him nervous.
Call was annoyed with Gus, who had still not returned. P had reported seeing him just after dawn, riding east in evident health. Call noticed the Texas Bull standing about 50 yards away. He was watching the two pigs who were rooting around a chaparral bush. Probably they were trying to root out a ground squirrel or perhaps a rattlesnake. The bull took a few steps toward them, but the pigs ignored him. Needle Nelson was scared of the bull. The minute he noticed him, he went to get his rifle out of a saddle scabbard.
"If he comes at me, I aim to shoot him," Needle said. "He'll never live to cross the Yellowstone unless he leaves me be."
Lippy, too, disliked the bull and climbed up on the wagon when he saw how close the bull was.
"He won't charge the camp," Call said, though in fact he was not so sure the bull wouldn't.
"Why, he charged Needle," Jasper said. "Needle had to get going so fast he near forgot his dingus."
At that, there was a general laugh, though Needle Nelson didn't join in. He kept his rifle propped against the wagon wheel while he was eating. The bull continued to watch the pigs.
Chapter 34.
As soon as the sun got high enough to be warm, Lorena spread their gear on trees and bushes to dry. It seemed astonishing to her that she was alive and unhurt after such a night. Her spirits rose rapidly, and she was even reconciled to having to ride the pack mule. But Jake wouldn't hear that. His own spirits were low.
"I hate to squish every move I make," he said. "It ain't supposed to get this wet in these parts."
Now that the scare was over, Lorena found that she didn't mind that things were damp. It beat being hot in her book. The only awkward part was that the few foodstuffs that they had brought had been soaked. The flour was ruined, the salt a lump. At least the bacon and the coffee weren't ruined, and they had a little of each before Jake rode off to look for her horse. Once he left, she went down to the river to wash the mud off her legs. Then, since the sun was already hot, she found a grassy place that wasn't too wet and lay down to have a nap. Looking up at the sky, her spirits rose even more. The sky was perfectly clear and blue, only whitened with sun over to the east. Being outside felt good. She had spent too much time in little hot rooms looking at ceilings. While she was resting, who should come riding up with her mare but Gus?
"I hope there's still some coffee in that pot," he said when he dismounted.
I've usually had 10 biscuits by this time of day, not to mention some honey and a few eggs. Got any eggs, Lori?
No, but we got bacon, she said. I'll fry you some.
Augustus looked around with amusement at the muddy camp. I don't see young Jake, he said. Is he off preaching a sermon, or did he wash away?
He went to look for the horse, only I guess he went in the wrong direction, Lori said. Augustus took out his big clasp knife and cut the bacon for her. For a woman who had spent the night being drenched, she looked wonderfully fresh, young, and beautiful. Her hair was not yet dry, and the wet ends were dark. Occasionally a little line of water ran down her bare arm. Bending over the fire, her face was relaxed in a way he had never seen it. The strain that always showed in Lonesome Dove, the strain of always holding herself apart, had disappeared, making her look girlish.
"Why, Lori," he said, "I guess traveling agrees with you. You look pretty as the morning."
Lorena smiled. It was funny. Out in the open, she felt more at ease with Gus than she had in the saloon.
"How long has Jake been gone?" he asked.
"Not long," she said. "He rode down the river looking for tracks."
Augustus laughed. "Why, Jake couldn't track an elephant if he was more than 10 steps behind it," he said. "I guess we ought to call him back before he gets lost."
He drew his pistol and fired a couple of shots into the air. A few minutes later, as he was finishing the bacon, Jake came galloping into camp, rifle in hand. Lorena was going around from bush to bush collecting the clothes, which the hot sun had already dried.
"Gus, I didn't know we was going to have you for breakfast every day of the whole trip," Jake said. "You was never grateful for nothing, Jake," Augustus said. "Here I return a $50 horse that you couldn't have found in a week, and all you can do is gripe about my company."
"Well, there's such a thing as too much of your darn company," Jake said, looking to see if Lori was out of hearing.
"Are you jealous or what?" Augustus asked.
"Why wouldn't I be? When you tried to poke every woman I ever looked at," Jake said.
"Whoa now," Augustus said. "I'm just eating my bite of bacon. But I will say you should have brought a tent if you mean to take a sprightly girl like Lori out in the weather."
Jake didn't intend to spend any time bannering about women with Gus. It was good that they had the horse back, of course. "I reckon we'll pack up and move on to San Antonio," he said, just as Lorena came back with an armful of dry clothes. "I don't want to go to San Antonio," she said. "I've been there." Jake was taken aback.
"Why, it's a good gambling town," he said. "We ain't rich yet. And it wouldn't hurt us to stop for a week while the boys get the herd started good. Then we can catch up."
"I don't like to go back to places," Lorena said. "It's bad luck."
"Yes, and it would be worse luck to get up the trail and run out of money." "That's all right, Jake," Augustus said, flinging the dregs of his coffee into a chaparral bush. "I'll be glad to keep tabs on Lori while you run into town and lose your wad."
"What makes you think I'd lose it?" Jake said, his face darkening.
"You'd lose it if I was around," Augustus said. "And if I wasn't handy, you'd probably get in a scrape and shoot another dentist. Besides, if anybody with a badge on is trying to hunt you up, I'd think the first place they'd look is San Antonio."
"If anybody with a badge on comes looking for me, he's apt to find more of me than he wants," Jake said. "Let's get packed, Lori. We might make town tomorrow if we push on." "I don't want to go to San Antonio," Lorena said again. She knew Jake hated to be contradicted, but she didn't much care. Before she could think, he whipped around and slapped her. Not hard, but it was a slap.
"Darn it all, I guess you'll go where I say go," he said, his face red with anger.
Lorena felt embarrassed to have been hit in front of Gus, but he seemed uninterested in what she and Jake did. Of course, he was just being polite. What else could he do? She remembered all the money Javier had pressed on her. It was lucky she had it. She looked at Augustus again and saw that he was quietly watching, waiting to see how she would handle Jake, who was glaring at her, expecting her to cry, probably.
but it had taken all the fury of the storm to make her cry. A little pop from him was just something to be ignored. She turned her back on him and walked off to start packing. In a minute, Jake cooled down sufficiently to come over and squat by the fire. "I don't know what's wrong with Lori," he said. "She's getting touchy." Augustus chuckled. "You're the one that's touchy. She didn't slap you." "Well, by God, why would she buck me?" Jake asked. "I'm the one that decides where we go and when we stop." "You may be and you may not be," Augustus said. "Maybe it ain't that simple." "It'll be that simple, or she'll have soon seen the last of me," Jake said. "I doubt she'll miss you, Jake," Augustus said. "You got your charms, but then I got my charms, too. I'll come and make camp with her if you decide you've had enough of her sass. I ain't violent like you, neither." "I didn't hurt her," Jake said. He felt a little guilty about the slap. It had upset him to ride in and see her sitting there with Gus, and then she bucked him. Gus always managed to aggravate whatever situation he was in with a woman. "I've got to go," Augustus said. "Captain Call will be mad as a hornet if I don't get back. Much obliged for the breakfast." "That's two you owe us," Jake said. "I hope you'll ride into town and buy us a feed when you're up that way." "Why, the two of you won't be in town," Augustus said. He trotted down to where Lorena was quietly packing the mule. "Don't forget to hobble that mare," he said. "I guess she ain't as tired of Lonesome Dove as we are. She was on her way home when I came across her."
"I'll hobble her," Lorena said. She gave Gus a grin. Jake's little flare-up had not affected her good spirits.
"You know, if you get any prettier, you won't be safe around me," Augustus said. "I might be forced to cut the cards with you again."
"No, I told you we were going to play a hand next time," Lorena said. "It'll give me a better chance."
"You look out for yourself," Augustus said. "That scamp runs off and leaves you. Well, you come and get me. You can find us by the dust."
"He won't leave," Lorena said. "He'll be fine." She watched Gus swim the muddy river. He waved from the other bank and soon disappeared into the brush. She went on packing. Soon Jake couldn't stand it and walked over.
"You oughtn't to provoke me like that," he said, looking a little hangdog. He tried putting his hands on her, but Lorena shrugged them off and went to the other side of the pack mule.
"I wasn't provoking you," she said. "I just said I wasn't going back to San Antone."
"Darn it, I'd like to gamble a little somewhere between here and Denver," Jake said.
"Go gamble," she said. "I never said you couldn't. I'll stay in camp."
"Oh, no doubt you've made arrangements with Gus," Jake said. "I guess he's planning to come over and teach you card tricks," he said bitterly, and turned on his heel. Lorena didn't mind. It was too pretty a day. The fact that Gus had found her horse was a good sign. She felt like riding. Even though the country was brushy, she felt like a lope, in fact. Jake could sulk if he wanted to. She was looking forward to the trip.
Chapter 35.
The day soon grew hot, and the cattle, tired from their all-night walk, were sluggish and difficult to move. Carl had to put half the crew on the drags to keep them going. Still, he was determined to get across the Nueces, for Dietz had said he expected it to storm again that night. There was no avoiding the brush entirely, but Dietz had found a route that took them slightly downriver, around the worst of the thickets. As they got close to the river, they began to encounter swarms of mosquitoes, which attacked horses and men alike, settling on them so thickly that they could be wiped off like stains. All the men covered their faces as best they could, and the few who had gloves put them on. The horses were soon flinching, stamping, and swishing their tails, their withers covered with mosquitoes. The cattle were restive, too, mosquitoes around their eyes and in their nostrils. Newt was soon so covered with blood from mashed mosquitoes that he looked as if he had been wounded in battle. Sean, who rode near him, was no better. Any inconvenience made Sean think of home, and the mosquitoes were a big inconvenience.
"Ah, I'd like to be going to Ireland. If I only knew where the boats were, I'd be going."
His face was lumpy from mosquito bites.
I guess we'll drown the skeeters when we hit the river, Newt said. It was the only thing that promised relief. He had been dreading the river, but that was before the mosquitoes hit. To make matters worse, one particular red cow had begun to irritate him almost beyond endurance.